Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayat and Hannah Kuonut. In this series, you will hear from leading experts offering their take on what needs to be done to promote climate foreign policy and provide you with the context you need to understand climate diplomacy today. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow us on Twitter under Climate Diplo.
Hey Raquel, it's just us two today, isn't it?
Yes, it's just us reflecting on the year 2021 and its multilateral momentum for climate security and diplomacy.
Wow, what a year. It feels like yesterday that we started to revive the Climate Diplomacy Podcast with our first episode together. And I have to say, I'm really glad we did. We started with an episode about COVID-19 and its profound global impacts. And who would have thought that actually we're still struggling with it today? Even though I don't want to speak about COVID-19 today in detail, because I don't want to go down that road. Instead, I really would like to focus on all the progress we've made on so many different levels with regard to climate, security, and diplomacy. And I really know I shouldn't play favorites, but let's start with climate security, if that's okay with you.
Certainly.
All right. So from time to time, I have the joy to peek behind the curtains of the United Nations and attend the United Nations Group of Friends on Climate Security. It is always a pleasure because it makes me realize on what level this topic is discussed, and it has this world policy feeling to it. What has been emphasized by these like-minded states over and over again is the process and progress around a thematic resolution about climate security risks. Could you maybe talk us through the journey of this topic?
Yes, absolutely. Let's get right to it. That's an important one. So Germany started to push for a resolution on climate security already during its Security Council membership in 2019 and 2020, actually mostly on the 2020 open debate on climate security in July. But at the time, it didn't gather enough support. But right now, the picture is already shifting because that's how these processes are, right? They start in one way and they then start in a wave. The picture is a little bit different because from the five new Security Council members that joined in January this year, 2021, three of those, which are Kenya, Ireland, and Norway, have flagged climate-related insecurity as a priority issue or as an issue, if not a priority. So certainly on the side of recognizing climate change as an insecurity issue. From the five other non-permanent members that will be finishing their term now in December, three of those, Niger, Estonia, and Tunisia, have worked to keep the topic in the agenda. So Niger, for example, hosted the debate on December 9th on security, terrorism, and climate change. And just to conclude the picture of who's sitting on the Security Council, the permanent five, we can't leave them out, right? So we also have there three states, France, US, and the UK, that generally support the anchoring of climate change as a security issue in the Council, albeit with engagement levels varying through time. Given that they're permanently in the Council, it's natural that their engagement shift throughout governments. And I think one good example of this would be in 2020 during the Trump administration, there was strong opposition from the US. But we can say that these three states are generally on the side of at least talking about climate change, let's say, in the Council. So what that means is all these country counting means that we had in 2021, this year, 9 out of 15 Council members in favor of a climate security resolution. And it was in this context that the Security Council held its open debate on climate and security this September, which I guess we can say was successful in making an even stronger case for the recognition of climate change as a threat to international security and therefore as an issue to be tackled by the body that has the mandate to address international security, namely the Security Council. So that was their progress. But the actual resolution never took flight. And I guess we know the reason. It's because the Security Council does not work with majority. As we know, it depends on the support of all permanent five members, all of which have veto rights. We have China and Russia who continue to stand on the way of progress in this matter. As we have seen once again, also in the latest debate on December 9th, not only opposing the resolution, but also other measures such as the creation of the Group of Experts on Climate and Security, which is officially an informal group today due to their opposition. They were also against pulling in the climate security mechanism to serve as a secretariat for the Group of Experts. So basically just an outright, this issue doesn't belong here kind of attitude. But that's an evergreen topic. We don't have to get too deep on it because there's nothing new about this. Now, looking ahead, connecting this to our short retrospective with Ireland and Kenya, which are strong proponents of a resolution leading on climate security in the Council, also alongside Norway and others that are in favor, such as Niger, as I just mentioned. They not only hosted the debate on December 9, but they also started their December presidency with a bang. They already initiated their presidency by bringing in the resolution issue straight to the table on their first day heading the council. So with all of this momentum, it's well possible that a resolution will be passed, hopefully sooner rather than later. Of course, the picture will change again with the new members that will join in January. Not a lot of climate proponents there, unfortunately. So much still needs to be seen. It's not only the resolution at play. Countries are also arguing for a special representative on climate and security, something that Niger also emphasized recently, and also much more coordinated multilateral action in general. But irrespective of when the resolution will be passed and all of the challenges encountered on the way, the usual reluctant actors, it is important to recognize that things are moving forward. The sheer amount of countries joining the cry for this resolution is already a good indication of this. So we can see that diplomacy and multilateralism will remain imperative for progress.
Thanks. And really interesting. Also really impressive to actually like see this topic developing over time. And I think it's a really good example of a multilateral process taking shape and evolving with more and more countries joining the ship. Multilateral action also was very much a part of the COP26 event, which Adelphi organized together with the German Federal Foreign Office and the Munich Security Conference. It was the first of its kind, so the first high-level climate security event at a COP ever, and the last step in an ambitious multilateral process towards an agenda for action on climate peace and stability, following on from the Berlin Climate Security Conference in 2021 and bridging to the Munich Security Conference in 2022. My central takeaway during this event was a clear consensus that climate and security should be an integral part of both climate action and foreign and security policy. I think this also became clear in what you just said and how you described the process, so that more and more countries really recognize that need, also publicly and on a multilateral stage. And speakers flagged climate change as an increasing important aspect of preventing conflict, but also highlighted the imperative of better linking adaptation and peace building. It was music to my ears, and I bet also to the ears of many others, that they emphasized the importance of cross-border, cross-sector and multilateral projects and indicated clear commitments and growing momentum to advance a common agenda to address climate-related security risks. Of course, now they also need to walk the talk, which always seems to be the hardest part for policymakers.
Certainly. And it's quite incredible that institutions that are actually primarily concerned with security, such as NATO, are today some of the strongest voices behind the climate security narrative. I think none of us had expected this shift. And these are instances that are not just hearing about the risks and impacts of a changing climate over human security through meetings and policy briefs, but they're actually having to deal with it. They're having to consider it in their strategic planning. They're also having to consider it in terms of budget and personnel. This is just an example, not NATO. So having NATO leaders declare climate change as one of the defining challenges of our times, I think that brings the conversation around climate and security to a whole new level, because these are not your typical climate advocates, right?
So true. The topic really picked up speed during 2021. And another thing we actually, in light of this, must talk about is this year's Berlin Climate and Security Conference. We've recorded two of our episodes during this conference. And if we are honest, for a few weeks, we were pretty much working on this day and night.
I have to say, I'm still amazed of what came out of this year's conference. This was already our third edition of the BCSC. And although the intention has always been from the beginning to gather the international climate and security communities under one umbrella, never have we gotten as close as we did this year. Quite literally, virtually the entire international community in the areas of climate change and security have, in some form or another, participated. That's incredible. And Hannah, you're behind the whole organization, including relationship with partners, the speakers, participants. Can you give us a glimpse of what went on BCSC 2021?
More than happy to. And just like you, I'm still amazed, like literally, how well it all went. So yeah, basically, this year's conference was bigger than ever. And I could bore you with our 31 partner organizations or the over 2,500 participants. But I think our audience can just easily read all of these things up in the conference summary, which is available on the conference website. Therefore, I will focus on the things that I think that were, in my opinion, really interesting during the conference and they stood out a bit. So already when preparing the sessions with our different partners, we realized that this year's conference really reflects the shift from analysis to action, which we increasingly saw within the last year in the sphere of climate security. So our partner organizations had more practical projects which they wanted to discuss instead of just concept or planned programs. And it was really great and enriching to see in how many different ways and fields this topic is now implemented. We've had sessions on gender and climate security, mediation, peace building, human mobility, food security, legal aspects, data, scenario development, environmental degradation, resource scarcity, locally informed solutions, you name it. The event on locally informed solutions with the Climate Security Expert Network actually was my favorite and a real highlight because it was the first time we ever recorded the Climate Diplomacy podcast live. And oh my God, I was so nervous when we started out, I have to be honest. But then
I didn't notice.
You didn't notice. Lucky me.
Absolutely not. It was great.
But then it was so interesting also to hear the experts exchange about the different regions and still find commonalities in how climate change affects them, but also in how we could tackle the challenge. Yeah, it was just a really interesting episode, I have to say. Some key takeaways from the conference, which also reflect the state of the art discussion around climate security, in my opinion, include the demand that multilateral climate action must be based on working across sectors and building bridges between the different communities of practice, that climate security analysis and decision-making on the ground must be context-specific, locally informed, and include the voices of women, marginalized and indigenous communities and youth. That was also something that really came out strongly in the CSAN episode we recorded. Programming should contribute to gender equality, climate adaptation, and peace building in an integrated way, particularly as women and girls are disproportionately impacted by climate security risks. This is also something I think we hear a lot from the Women, Peace, and Security agenda and the wish to entangle it closer to the climate security agenda, which in my opinion makes a lot of sense. And also the learning that to achieve sustainable peace, climate lenses need to be integrated into context-specific gender and conflict analysis and vice versa, which we also discussed together with Janani Vivekananda, Michael Keating, and Janelle Galvanek in one of our episodes, which was also recorded during BCSC, where we talked about climate security as an opportunity for mediation. And there's also a need for additional funding for climate mitigation and adaptation measures that also incentivize peace and reach the most vulnerable communities. And last but not least, risk-informed and science-based data must be combined with context-specific qualitative analysis to drive effective climate security responses. This is also something very dear to our hearts in the Weathering Risk Project, which I find very interesting. So maybe the audience can check it out if they're interested. And to quote Rachel Omamo, Cabinet Secretary for Foreign Affairs in Kenya, fairness, justice, inclusivity of women, fact-based action, and reliance on science must underpin our efforts to drive forward a multilateral momentum on climate security. And to be honest, I really couldn't have summarized it better in my own words.
And if I had to summarize the outcomes of the BCSC 2021 conference in one sentence, I'd say we're moving away from the what's and moving towards the how's, because there was a lot of clarification on how to do things there. So quite coming closer to the implementation that we so desperately need.
So true.
Yeah. And our audience can rewatch the open sessions in the Adelphi YouTube channel, right?
Yes. Thanks to you. So Raquel, thanks again. all the recordings are available on our YouTube playlist on the Adelphi channel. We will link it in the show notes and you can just watch it as long and as often as you like. But enough of climate security and BCSC. Let's look at climate diplomacy. I'd say 2021 was an equally interesting year. America, for example, made climate change a priority in their national and international policies.
Yeah, that's true. The US rejoining the climate club, it's still big news because so much is still being put to motion as a result of this return. Of course, it's not all flowers. President Biden still had to grapple with getting things going internally. So now the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill was signed in November, which is a completely impressive feat for the Biden administration. It is not a climate bill per se, but it does contain around $150 billion that are earmarked for climate initiatives. So that's a great win, I think, for any measure. So with that out of the way, let's say attention will now turn towards pushing the much more complex agenda, Build Back Better, which already played a big role in Biden's election campaign. If this is accomplished, that would put the US on track for a 50% emission reduction by 2030. I don't think anyone in the world is on track for this, as long as I'm aware. That would be absolutely amazing for the whole world, given that the US is a top emitter. But there's some way to go until we find out if his trademark agenda will take flight. These are some of the main issues going on a national level. Internationally, the US return to being an actor with which other states want to cooperate and exchange in this area? So, for example, the Transatlantic Climate Bridge, which is a German initiative that started already in 2008, is not new, but it started to stimulate and expand this transatlantic exchange on climate and energy policy. It was called back to life now in 2021 due to America being back in the picture. Since March, Germany already organized an online forum, a multi-stakeholder dialogue, and even put together its own platform to house all these processes, its events, its publications, and so forth, which will emerge from this work between Germany, US, and Canada. They actually have a brand new Twitter account, which might be interesting for some of our listeners working with policy, particularly energy. It's climate_bridge. But this is just an example of so many initiatives. At COP26, the US has renewed and reaffirmed its commitment to climate action. It made an agreement with China to boost cooperation on combating climate change in several ways, including developing regulatory frameworks and boosting renewables and deploying technologies. And let's not forget that these two are the two world top emitters of greenhouse gases. So this is not your day-to-day bilateral agreement. And the US also led the Global Methane Pledge together with the EU and got more than 100 countries to sign it and agree to collectively reduce methane emissions by 30% by 2030. 2030 is this number, right, that we always had in our minds in the last decade, but it's actually right around the corner. So the commitments are getting bigger and bigger. This is very relevant, the Global Methane Pledge, because methane is not only generated by burning fossil fuels, but it also through agricultural activity, livestock, land conversion. So it goes beyond this energy focus that tends to dominate. The US was arguably quite ambitious in its commitments, but it does leave a bitter taste because by now everyone is already getting tired of all these amazing commitments and ambitions while so much is happening that just shouldn't be. So we can only declare COP26 a success retroactively when in a few years we see that these commitments actually made it into policies and are under implementation.
I couldn't agree more. And now that you've mentioned it, like the risk of, to put it in Greta's words, blah, 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 in climate diplomacy is of course present. So I think there are different ways to frame it, but a worse alternative would be not to have all these agreements and just wait it out, right?
I agree. And then there are also several ways to look at it. And if you look around the climate community right now, the general feeling is of just these baby steps and maybe it's a partial disappointment right after the COP. This is the feeling you get when you compare the actual outcomes with the outcomes that were needed to avert the crisis scenarios. Of course, looking from that perspective, it just doesn't add up. But looking from the perspective of how fast this issue is advancing on an international level, I have to say I'm actually quite impressed. And just to give you an example, I still wear the same pair of jeans that I used to wear when the climate and environmental communities were still fighting to get this issue on the international agenda. It was yesterday in the time axis terms. Today, there's barely an instance in the international community that oversees the climate and environmental dimensions. And when they do, they will be named and shamed because it's just unequivocally relevant for everyone. It belongs on the top of every agenda. It's obvious. We are living through a paradigm shift, but I guess we are too close to see it or to feel it. It's like, you know, when you have your eyes so close to the TV screen and then you can't see the whole movie. You can only see these pixels. And people might tell you that those pixels, they actually form a coherent picture and you can believe them or you cannot believe it, but you yourself, you can't see it. And at this point, I can almost hear our listeners thinking, but that doesn't help us. We need action right now. That doesn't help. And that's all true. So there's no, I'm not going to say that people are wrong, but it's just that this is of course very personal. I firmly believe that the real tangible transformation, the one that we desperately need, has to be preceded by a paradigm shift. Because if it isn't, it will be superficial. It will be insufficient. It will be temporary. We need this paradigm shift to happen in all layers of society, in all regions, throughout all sectors. Anyway, it's all about the holistic, integrative, and inclusive transformation that we've been hearing about so much lately. And all of this sounds a bit abstract, I guess. But again, because it is too big and comprehensive to put in concrete terms. So in my opinion, I don't know. I think this paradigm shift has already begun. And we don't need to wait for it to finish to move forward. But I do feel we must respect the process. What about you? What do you think about this, Hannah?
Yeah, that's also a really difficult question for me. I'm also partially divided. So I completely agree with you in many points, and it was a success in so many different aspects, and it definitely is important to address the topic on such a high level. But as many, especially also young people, I'm also disappointed because the process is so slow. And to be frank, also, it seems to be too slow. So yeah, I'm really like, in German, we say sitting between the chairs. It really describes my feelings with regard to this, because on the one hand, being part of so many multilateral processes and really seeing how the topic increased its importance. And on the other hand, being a young person, like wanting to live on that planet for a very long time to come, really desperately trying to draw attention to all these issues. Yeah. But I also have to say that when starting at Adelphi and looking back now, I think we really came a long way, and we shouldn't underestimate that process and progress also on a multilateral level. The topic really moved more into the center of debates on international security and also connected with other agendas in security, such as the Women, Peace and Security agenda.
Absolutely. That's a healthy attitude, because we can't get too positive about it, right? Otherwise we stop moving forward. So that's certainly a healthy attitude. And now from one multilateral event to another multilateral process, should we also talk maybe a little bit about the European climate law?
Of course, you're right, we should. When looking back at 2021, that definitely was a memorable event. So for those of our listeners who don't follow European policy that closely, the European climate law was passed in June this year, and it writes into law the goal set out in the European Green Deal for Europe's economy and society to become climate neutral by 2050. Which is a big step, because the European Union is the world's largest economic bloc, and it is now officially going climate neutral. The law also sets the intermediate target of reducing net greenhouse gas emissions by at least 55% by 2030 compared to 1990 levels. Raquel, you already said it, 2030 is just around the corner, so that we really need to take action now to achieve this. And climate neutrality by 2050 means achieving net zero greenhouse gas emissions for European countries as a whole, mainly by cutting emissions, investing in green technologies, but also protecting the natural environment. And the law converts the EU's net zero target from aspiration to obligation, which is a real important step if the European Union wants to walk their talk.
That is true. Would you say that Europe is now effectively on the road towards the 2050 climate neutrality objective throughout its policies?
Looking at that law, I'd say yes. So it even sets a more ambitious EU 2030 target. And to set Europe on a responsible path to becoming climate neutral by 2050, and creates a system for monitoring progress and take further action if needed, even though, as we both know very well, policymakers are really reluctant to monitoring and evaluation processes. It also provides predictability for investors and other economic actors, and aims to ensure that the transition to climate neutrality is irreversible. So really setting this into stone and not having just a very superficial way of sustainable trade. And the law also sends a strong signal. It emerges from years of negotiation and dialogue between the political parties and between 27 member states with very different economies, per capita incomes and energy mixes. And we all know how difficult it can be to agree with a group of friends on a restaurant, or more recently on something to eat on a Christmas market. But now where to eat dinner is a decision that only matters in this specific moment. But just imagine you need to find a compromise regarding a decision that will impact all other decisions you will make over the next decades and over all the time to come.
Yeah, that's a very big step indeed for climate diplomacy. No wonder it made our retrospective. And it's important also at this point to highlight also for our listeners the role of this law, because the European climate law itself, it doesn't determine the paths to achieving climate neutrality goals. This is just something that is being addressed in the EU Green Deal and also through several other legislations. What the European climate law does is to make going net zero by 2050, as Hannah said, legally binding. So it means if somewhere in Europe, let's say a right-wing government is elected in the next years and they oppose these goals, they have no possibility of stepping down from them retroactively. So it's a completely new thing. And one thing that is very important is that policy decisions, they will no longer require unanimity. They can pass just by a qualified majority. And I think that this alone will help to clear several bottlenecks, because you don't have to convince every single one. You can have a little group of actors that are not in favor of something, a law can still pass. And this should accelerate the pace of policy making, this alone, right? The EU Parliament will also be involved in policy decisions, as opposed to only member states, as it has been up until now, so thereby making the whole process more democratic too.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That really was an important aspect. Thanks for adding, Raquel. And while we were talking about the European Union, this reminded me about the EU trade policy review. I'm certainly not a trade specialist, but as far as I've heard, it does not aim to make specific policy suggestions, but it intends to provide a strategic framework for the European Union's trade policy in the coming 5 years. So I think it's also important to address it quickly in our review. Many jobs depend on trade, and trade policy faces an increasingly challenging environment, including tensions between the world's biggest economies, America and China, but also protectionism, COVID-19, high expectations from all of us regarding sustainability and the rapid growth of the digital sphere and trade as well. So we shouldn't neglect this in our review. The trade policy centers around three medium objectives, which are green and digital transformation, shaping global rules for a more sustainable and fair globalization, and stricter enforcement of the EU's rights and interests. So far, so good. But to achieve these objectives, the trade policy review considers six broad policy measures. The first one is the reform of the WTO, of which we could do a whole podcast episode of itself. And the EU also wants to promote responsible and sustainable value chains, which means that climate change will need to be part of future trade agreements. They also want to support the digital transition and trade services, for example, by agreeing to global standards and strengthening the EU's regulatory impact and partnership with Africa. And last but not least, they want to focus on the implementation and enforcement of EU trade agreements. Now, you could say, why is this climate diplomacy? But when taking a closer look, especially the alignment of trade and climate change policies is an important step in the right direction. The review focuses on creating the conditions for cooperation on sustainable development and implementation of the Paris Agreement, and seeks to strengthen the enforcement of commitments around special and differential treatment. However, one could argue that the emphasis on punitive rather than enabling measures could risk disengaging the EU's trade partners. One important key question is how trade and climate actions, such as border carbon adjustments, can be implemented in an effective and fair way, considering the priorities of the different partners, which often include industrial development, and considering also the knock-on effects on supply chains involving low-income countries. Another question is how the European Union can work with the WTO to ensure all climate response measures that affect trade are included in trade policy review mechanisms, and also how the European Union can ensure adequate support for low-income countries to develop common monitoring, reporting, and verification frameworks to support the reduction of carbon in trade. For all those interested in aspects of trade and climate change, we can highly recommend the episode 14, where we discuss European climate diplomacy in a post-COVID-19 world and also dive deeper into a lot of economic and trade aspects. But I guess it's time to wrap up now. What a year. We've already said so many different topics. I guess we could talk for hours, as we always
could. We could.
Always. Could. That's our biggest problem.
We have to stop talking.
Yeah, with all our guests. It always was so interesting that I wanted to go on and on and on. But okay. I have to say, it was a real, real pleasure to do this podcast together with you.
Oh, and a huge, right back at you.
Thank you. And a huge thank you goes, I think, from both of us. Also to Henriette and Claudia, who are the helping hands in the background. And also
absolutely.
To everyone from our amazing team who is doing very important and great work. And yeah, I keep my fingers crossed that we will be able to continue the next year in the same spirit we left this one.
Or an even better one. Let's hope.
Also good. I agree. And for last time this year, I hand over to you, Raquel.
Thank you so much. I can only second everything you said. I'm so happy we have such a great team and we're seeing firsthand all this progress and processes. And it's really just amazing to be here. And I think in the end of the year, we can just stop, take a look at just all we've seen and lived through, right? So, yeah. We will be back with another episode of the Climate Diplomacy Podcast in a few weeks. Meanwhile, we wish you happy holidays. And for all of those who don't celebrate holidays at this time, we hope you have a great time too and enjoy a deserved break from the rest of us. But whether celebrating or not, just remember to stay safe and healthy. Thank you for tuning in. And until 2022, goodbye.
Goodbye, everyone.